The Musician's Musician Podcast is brought to you by you. For real. We rely on listener donations to grow the show, so if you'd like to support what we do, you can set up a one-time or recurring donation. Just follow the link in the description. It's super easy, because PayPal. A huge thanks to those of you who have already given. We also want to ask if you could be so kind as to rate and subscribe to the program on whatever platform you use to listen to us. It helps the show reach more ears, and we love your feedback. Okay, on to the show. So, Max, you and I oftentimes will grind axes over varying subject matter, but no exception within the space of music and audio applications. And you sent me a troubling video earlier today, and you and I had a lengthy discussion about it, both via Messenger as well as off air. So I have a lot to say about it, but can you very briefly fill in the others about what it is that has pissed us off today in the media sphere?
I am so mad about this still. Man. There's a well-known producer and engineer that made a video saying that basically the wood that your guitar is made out of does not matter. That there is no difference in tonal characteristics of a guitar, regardless of the wood that is used. And he posted blind tests. And you go through them on YouTube and listen to it. And I thought, wow, these are exceptionally different. And he, at the end of it, he's like, there's no difference. They're exactly the same. And I'm like, what? This is not, do you have ears? It was so frustrating to me. And I thought I was above this, but I'm not. And I took to Facebook and made a post. Yeah. And people commented on it, and I had discourses back and forth with them. And then I, like,
we know how productive of a method that is.
Yeah, that just made me more mad. But gosh, well, there's a lot of people that there's a lot of people that just miss the whole logical argument that's going on there,
right?
And or are not using their ears.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I am completely in agreement with your stance on this thing. And if you out there agree or disagree with our take on this, we're not going to dig into what our lengthy positions on this are, but do reach out to us. I'd be curious to know if you agree. If so, we'll give you a thumbs up, and if not, we'll give you a proper rebuttal. Having
and we won't be mean. We're not mean, you know, like, good discussion.
Yeah,
but you know, have evidence.
We need more civil discourse in this horrible climate, social and civil and political climate that we're in. So
absolutely,
let's talk about more trivial things. But
but, you know, that being said, it actually was really a good kind of precursor to, like, getting in the headspace to talk about our subject today, because this man is no stranger to the subtle. In fact, as we were talking offline before this, I think that's really his kind of his calling card, his claim to fame.
Yes. So we are talking about Thomas Newman. And that may or may not be a familiar name to you, but I would wager any amount of anything that you have heard this guy before. unless you live under a rock and consume zero media your whole life, then you might not have heard him. But he is a very well-known, very prolific film composer. He has done some absolute music, but vast majority of the work that he's done has been within the realm of film scoring. There are a billion film composers that we could have chosen to talk about. We ultimately went with him, one, for that very reason, because you're probably familiar with him, or at least have heard some of the movies that he's done, and we'll talk more about that later. But also, he has an approach to composing that isn't maybe exactly what you would think about when you're trying to convey something in a film through the medium of music. However, it still accomplishes the same goal in a very powerful way, but it is a little bit different. So it doesn't really sound like John Williams, right? Which I think that is a bit more of a household name. I would not say that Thomas Newman and John Williams sound the same, you know?
Not at all.
So, but that's why we wanted to talk about him, because he's been around long enough to and done so many movies that he has been tremendously influential on generations of film composers that have followed him.
Well, not just film composers. I think it's really come into affecting how we as a society consume visual media.
Sure.
Because his influence on like what we expect from a film score is very different, I think, because of how he approaches his composition.
Definitely.
So kind of with that, we're really not going to spend much time on his growing up and formative years, because boy, do we have a lot to cover.
Yeah.
There is so much good stuff to dive into. He came from a musical family. His father is a composer.
A film composer at that.
Yes, absolutely. And comes really from a dynasty of these film scoring people. His older brother, his younger sister, his uncle's cousin, and more. There are more.
Well, and I have to mention too, Randy Newman is his cousin, and you know, Randy Newman's known for many things, but notably, You've Got a Friend in Me. That's Randy Newman, right?
Right. Yeah. So I mean, they're all very good at what they do.
Well, and like very very successful at that.
Yeah. And that being said, Thomas Newman didn't grow up necessarily wanting to be a composer. He played piano and violin. And his father died when I think he was 14, and he hadn't really pulled his son Thomas, at least. I mean, I don't know about the other kids, but he had had a certain amount of struggle in his life and wasn't trying to push his child into this direction and this career path. But it is still something that Newman chose to follow, and he really found his niche there. He went to school at University of Southern California, studying composition and orchestration, transferred to Yale, and got his bachelor's and master's there. Stephen Sondheim was a mentor of his. If you're familiar with his musicals, he's a fantastic composer.
Somebody who we'll probably do an episode on someday.
I hope so. I actually, fun fact, when I started college, I got to do like this week-long like honors sort of week thing, and I took a course on Stephen Sondheim.
Oh, nice.
For a week. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
I did grow up under a rock, and so I didn't know his stuff. But anyway, he's been very influenced by a large number of things, because he grew up listening to like the Beatles and to the contemporary music of the time, but is also very much around chamber music and this classical tradition. And I know I can't say this for certain, but like when I listen to Thomas Newman, of the many things that I hear, like I hear Aaron Copland, like I hear like composers from the 20th century that have really left their mark on him. But then I also hear an extremely clear presence of modern contemporary music from a variety of styles. And he takes inspiration from a vast array of places. And I feel like wherever he can get it, he's interested in getting inspiration and being creative with it.
Yeah, one of the things that I also think is very interesting, and I'll refer back to this again, but he also explicitly talks about how he was very very influenced by a lot of the early and middle 20th century kind of more modern abstract composers, like, you know, like the Schoenbergs, who we've mentioned before, Charles Ives or Morton Feldman or Webern or Berg, like a lot kind of more the German school. But a lot of that music is really attempting to create a vibe. It's I wouldn't say it's atmospheric, because I feel like that gives the wrong impression. If you think back to the Philip Glass episode and how a sound is filling a space and how you're experiencing it, the temporal aspect of it is a lot more ambiguous. And I feel like that is an approach that Glass admits that he also got from a lot of these guys, but that, you know, as another branch in that evolutionary arm, this is a place also that is hugely influential on how Thomas Newman is going about creating like a sort of an atmosphere for a scene.
Absolutely. And this atmospheric approach is something that we hear in a variety of different genres. It's not just in modern classical music. It's not just in film scoring. You'll hear it in progressive rock. You'll hear it in indie. You'll hear it in all sorts of places, but it really comes back. It comes back to the musician's musician's musician.
Right.
But yeah, there's so much going on that really does influence him. And if you listen to his scores, I mean, you listen to the soundtrack of whatever movie that he worked on Spotify or Apple Music, it's going to be there. You might have to dig, because it might be listed under various artists. We'll get back to that later. But as you listen, you'll hear things that belong somewhere else, but don't seem out of place. They're still very much Thomas Newman's. He definitely has a sound and a character and an approach, while doing an exceptional job, in my opinion, of producing something that's appropriate for the time and place that he's working in. And as we talk about influences, we are really talking about a lot of these outside influences coming in. We're not really talking about people that he's working with so much, like colleagues and scenes that he is in. Like, the film scoring scene is not like the jazz scene. It's not like a lot of other collaborative music environments. Film scoring is very different, and your coworkers are not necessarily musicians. And Thomas Newman does a very good job of working with these people, like a producer of a film, to create something. And that's different than working with like a recording engineer or a music producer that speaks the same language as you, because these people have personalities and ideas and whatnot, just like everyone else. But I think it's important that he's able to really pull in the essence of what these people are talking about and meaning, and put that into music.
Yeah. And something that people of a Thomas Newman status, or Hans Zimmer's really low-hanging fruit, Hans might be a little bit more of a well-known name than Thomas. I don't know what people know. I'm like not well positioned to have a pulse on anything, but
Hans Zimmer is definitely a household name.
Well, in either case, particularly film composers that are of that sort of a status where they are working with a lot of money and a huge budget, they very oftentimes will have a team of composers working under them as well. So a lot of times what will happen in a process sort of a standpoint, and this is gonna lead into talking about kind of philosophical underpinnings, which we have a lot to say about, but he'll get together with his team, and something that will happen, not that this is how everything is conceived, but something that will happen is they'll have a particular scene or theme that they're working with or trying to develop, and he'll sit down and improvise, right, at a piano, typically. They'll record it, and then with his team, they'll kind of pull different pieces out of that, maybe pull a piece of it, be like, okay, this can be like a very strong motivic force. So let's plug this in here. Okay, let's experiment with these different sounds to see how this is working with this and blah, 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 blah. 2 points, I guess, I want to make with that. One is that something that you'll come to learn when we're talking about composers, if this isn't something you're already familiar with, is that composers are typically very good improvisers. All improvisation is spontaneous composition. And these compositional ideas are coming from something. So that's a really big theme. Something that we talked about with in the Messiaen episode, how Messiaen was allegedly a very good improviser. Thomas Newman apparently is as well. And that's something you're going to hear with composers a lot, and improvisers. The other point I wanted to make with it too, though, is that there's a lot of trial and error that happens, with this music. Something that I really like about him is that he's not totally married to an idea. So he might have an idea that he really liked working with for a particular scene or something. The director will come in and see the ideas that he's working with a scene. And if the director tells him, that's not at all what I was looking for here, try this and this, he's, you know, what's the phrase? You say jump.
I say how high.
Idioms are hard. But he's very much one of those guys, which is a big part of the reason why people like working with him, is because directors will very oftentimes have a very clear vision as to what they're trying to convey in a given scene. And Thomas is your guy for being like, here was my take on this. Sometimes it works, but he's willing to say, okay, that didn't work. Here's some other ideas.
And that's such an important quality to have. I can't even say how many people I've worked with, and even myself, who you just get married to this idea and you can't let it go. And being someone easy to work with just really takes you places. I think that's just a remarkably important quality that allows you to continue to be creative rather than being stuck trying to workshop this one idea and, you know, continue to beat the dead horse when it's definitely not what is supposed to be there. And he seems to have a very agile composing method, really. I mean, he's going about and he's not letting himself get so bogged down by stuff. I mean, with today's film scoring, you don't have like the final cut like you do in old movies. Like, there, it's definitely a more iterative process. And, you know, with our modern recording tools and software, you can do a lot very quickly.
Right.
And, you know, before you ever get the orchestra in the studio. But boy, there are philosophies behind this man, and we are here for them. Parker, do you want to take us away on that? Let's get this ball rolling.
Something that I really like about him is that he talks about how it's really important to stay practical and to stay on task. So this might sound like kind of a tedious or trivial point to be bringing up.
Doesn't everyone need to do that, Parker?
Indeed. But in the case of the kind of work that he's doing, he's working on huge, huge, huge movies, which we'll mention some of those later on when we give some recommendations for where to check him out. But Max and I both watched an interview that he did at the Oxford Union, which I highly recommend checking out. It is a wealth of knowledge. A lot of really, really interesting takes. Somebody asked him the question of if he feels a lot of pressure for working on these huge movies, or like if he has this sort of awareness that it's going to be another Oscar nomination or something like that. And he basically just makes the point that it's like, you don't know at the time if this is going to be like an Oscar nominated film. You have no idea how this movie is going to be received. You have no idea in the final editing of the movie how the role that your music is going to play in this in a lot of ways. So the thing that you just need to do is just assume that this is going to be a good movie and that you need to just be doing your best work all the time. So whether or not it's going to be an Oscar nominated score, whether it's going to be an Oscar nominated movie, that's not relevant. You always just need to be putting out your best work.
Well, and that's something that he talks about, is that like this creative process that he has is something that is always going on. And I think that's definitely a common thread through creatives. It's something that is always, always present. And he does have things that he does to like disconnect, but you know, when you think that way, and I feel like when you're that good at your work, you need to be that entrenched in it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the reasons that he's able to find influence and inspiration in so many places, is because he's always seeing something as a creative, as something creative to bring to the table.
One more idea that I want to kind of put forward that he talks about is to not make the music redundant to what is happening on the screen, but to do so cautiously. So the music still needs to support the film, right? Like if something sad is happening, you need to be creating a sad vibe. If there's something a lot of jubilee in a scene. You need to be representing that. It's become almost a trope to like have like a big reunion happen between the two lovers and to have the string section just sawing away, and it's just this like overly dramatic, like Wagnerian sort of over the top, oh my god, I can't believe this happened, right? He's trying to avoid that in a sense. So he still wants you to feel that rejoicing or that sadness or that tragedy or that confusion or that mystery, but he doesn't want to beat you over the head with it. I mean, that's why that Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, that main theme that everybody knows from that piece, that has become a trope for love scenes in movies. People just throw that in there because it's just like, ah, geez, like this is the big like young lovers moment, whatever. And it's a joke.
That's gonna work.
It's always inserted as a joke anymore. And so he's very much leaning away from that and trying to communicate this again. It's a more atmospheric effect than it is like this overt, it's love, you know?
I think the really cool thing about that is he's figured out how to really marry, use the love thing again, marry the visual and the audible cues that you're getting.
Right.
He's using the music as a catalyst rather than trying to tell the story just outrightly with the music. And this approach is so effective. It really pulls you in because it's, to me, it's really hitting you from a different side. Like you have this visual story that you're getting, and you have the audio like of the, you know, the dialogue or whatever, but then you have this magic that he's able to pull out, and it enhances. It really catalyst is, I think, the best word, because it's not supposed to, it's like lighting in a scene, it's like lighting on a stage. Lighting is seldom like the point, but the point is that it makes whatever is happening that much better. And him being able to represent emotion in music in such a way that it adds rather than taking attention, I think, is really important.
I like that. I think it's a good analog. There's a lot more that we could say in regards to philosophical underpinnings. I love learning about these people and their process, because I also write a lot of music, and it's always very informative to be kind of getting into their headspace. But it's also extremely informative to just get into the music and what's actually happening there. So there's a lot, way too much to say again in this space, but we'll try to keep it brief, and you can go listen to it for yourself. But Max, you want to kind of get us rolling into talking about what is like the Thomas Newman thing, and, you know, start wherever you'd like with that.
Yeah, you bet. There's definitely this sound that keeps coming back. You know, all of his stuff that I've listened to, which I have not listened to everything, as much as I would like to do that at some point in my life.
There's too much.
That's just not going to happen. Yeah. There are definitely instrumentations that he keeps coming back to. He really loves an orchestra. I mean, just a classic 20th century style symphony orchestra. And that comes in and out all the time. And he's very clever with it. It's not like he just does the same thing every time, but he definitely has a style with which he approaches his composition with that ensemble. And you listen to a couple of different soundtracks and you'll start to pick that up. But in conjunction with that, Thomas Newman is renowned, I would say, for using obscure instruments and obscure sounds. He'll have someone in the orchestra or that he's working with on the music say like, man, I got this weird instrument, and you know, it sounds really good in this key, and they'll just go with that. And if you listen to his stuff, you'll hear these sounds that may not be traditional sounds. He does walk this line, and this is kind of a philosophy, but going back and forth between like, is this sound something that would have been time appropriate in the film, or does it just still work? And sometimes it does. And that's something that he talks about and is cognizant of, because that's very much something that will inform how he composes and what instruments he uses in his composition. But this marriage between the symphony orchestra and these odd, just kind of extra instruments are very much part of his sound. But then again, he's also not afraid to use rock band. Like, he's using electronic instruments. He's using, like, metal guitars. Like, whatever it takes, he's going to do it. But there's always kind of this base in which everything will still feel like Thomas Newman.
Well, and I feel like one of the big drivers for that is that he's very cognizant of rhythm, right? So if we're gonna kind of, you know, break music down into very more abstracted, larger components, we could say we have melody, harmony, and rhythm. Okay, so he is huge on the rhythm side of things, and you hear that in his earlier scores. I feel like it's a bit more heavy-handed in how he's driving motific ideas is via rhythm, but that always seems to lay a foundation, whether or not there is like a large percussion section happening in something that he's doing. He always has, at least in moments that it makes sense to have it anyway, there's always a really interesting rhythmic component going on. And that's an approach to film scoring that he certainly didn't innovate, but that he kind of had become more or less the expectation, I think. I think recently to the Dark Knight soundtrack, and a lot of the themes in the Dark Knight are rhythms. They're not melodic themes, they're rhythmic themes. And again, not saying that Thomas Newman invented that, but again, it's one of the things that he sort of laid as an expectation for, like, this is a powerful thematic driver. And it's not necessarily something that you always heard in film scores, you know, throughout the history of film. So that's something really important to him. A movie to check out that I feel like captures that really well, or I mean, there's a lot of them, but The Player, as well as American Beauty. It's a very very percussion driven soundtrack.
Well, and with that, we probably won't get back to this because there's so much to cover. There is a famous scene in there called the plastic bag scene.
Yeah.
And you can find YouTube clips of it. It's in the movie itself. And it's a beautiful thing. Check it out.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a rhythmic thing, but in that movie, you need to see what he can do to really elevate a scene.
One other thing I really, really briefly just want to touch on harmony. There's a lot to be said about harmony that's typical to film scores, and I'm not going to try and unpack all of that. One, because I am not a film composer, so I would be making a lot of assumptions. But two, there's just way too much to even try to unpack. So having said that, though, with these more atmospheric approaches that we keep mentioning, you're not always going to hear this really obvious chord progression or like really sweeping melodic movement with like a very clear direction in terms of like harmonic motion. That's not always what's happening. Again, it might be a little bit more rhythmically driven, or it might be even more driven by some sort of a drone with a much more ambiguous sort of soundscape happening on top of that. That's something else that he does a lot to kind of create an atmosphere, and it's a bit more ambiguous in that it's not an overt, unthreadable song or anything like that. It's a lot more abstract, a little bit more in the minimalist realm, I guess you could say, in a way. But it also, again, makes me think of like the Morton Feldman sort of a vibe, where it's like there is not a clear key center happening here, per se. But it does. But in this context, it's not like it's this weird, crazy thing. It's just, it's a vibe. But next time you watch a movie that Thomas Newman scored for, you're going to notice those moments regardless of the instrumentation.
So, Parker, who would we say that Thomas is similar to?
Oh, man. It's hard to say, having mentioned Hans Zimmer already, there are a lot of aspects to their approach into creating an ambiance in a movie that I think are similar. Danny Elfman is another very prolific film composer that a lot of people are may or may not be familiar with. Sort of a similar generation as Thomas. So there's you know, inherently going to be some similarities in their approaches. But Gretzky is like one of the great minimalist composers of the 20th century. If you're not familiar with him, check him out. I feel like there's a lot of Gretzky going on in Newman's playing. A lot of the minimalists, I think, even though I wouldn't say that Thomas Newman's music is of a minimalist nature per se, I think there are a lot of aspects in modern music, again, as we discussed in the Philip Glass episode, that have really bled heavily into a lot of domains within the composition sphere.
Well, and there are also some non-classical or non-film composers that I think we could put in there. Stylistically and conceptually, if we were to look at Sigur Rós, there are some very strong ties that you'll see. Mm. Even if you were to look at Devin Townsend, there are some strong philosophic connections. I think of artist Stephen Wilson, more so of his older stuff, but...
Sure.
Those are some like rock, progressive rock, metal, like non-classical, non-film score people that I think share at least some philosophic similarities with Thomas Newman.
Yeah.
Because I think there are a lot of ways that we can relate composers together. But
nice. Well, how would you? I mean. You know, we haven't done a film composer yet, but the way to get into them might be kind of obvious. But nevertheless, Max, how would you recommend somebody dive into Thomas Newman?
Well, because there's something that he's done that you're already familiar with, I think the best way is to go and look through what he's already done and see what you know. Like, go find Finding Nemo and watch it again, but with Thomas Newman in mind.
Right.
You know, like having that connection with something that you're already familiar with, I think really allows you to make this connection with the music because you're not needing to be focused on the story. You know, you can allow yourself to feel it a little deeper. There are so many movies in so many different genres. Like Parker said, there is some absolute music that is performed even today. I mean, it's not like he's not one of the big absolute music composers. He doesn't do a whole lot of it, but he definitely does. So you could see him. Or you could see people playing his music.
He puts butts in seats.
He does. Absolutely. I mean, I would go see it.
Yep.
but yeah, there are so many movies that he's worked on, and many per year. He is extremely prolific. So I think go to his Wikipedia page. Check out his, it's not his discography, I guess it's his filmography.
Yeah.
Yeah. and find something that, you know, that you're interested in. Like, this might be, it might be something you watch for, I don't know, a Wednesday night. Or put it on while you're doing your work. I don't know, date night, whatever. Find a movie, watch it.
Yeah.
But there, you can also listen to these scores on Spotify and Apple Music. That's how I did the bulk of my preparation for this episode and thoroughly enjoyed it. I was really able to get a lot out of that. So I believe that you can too, should you desire. But with that, Parker, we've got some picks. There are so many. And
there are so many.
Let's do three. Is that okay?
Sure. It's hard because it's like it'd be easy to do 10. I mean, his...
Oh, absolutely.
He's done and the thing is he's done so many movies that I'm sure you've already seen. But if I had to do three, American Beauty really is a killer, killer soundtrack. Shawshank Redemption was my introduction to Thomas Newman, or at least when I first became cognizant of Thomas Newman. The score for that movie was the score that made me be like, who wrote the music for this? So Shawshank Redemption's killing. You know, I'm gonna say Wall-E as my third pick.
Gosh darn it, Parker.
Are those your three picks?
No, they're not my three picks, but two of them were.
Okay. Well, the reason I like Wall-E, just really briefly, I like Wall-E a lot because there's a lot of the movie that doesn't have dialogue. So it's being driven by the music. And he knocks it out of the park. I mean, Wall-E is a fun movie anyway. But the reason you love those first 30 minutes is because of the music. And like the cute little robot. But the music. So, I don't know. What about you?
Man, I was going to pick Shawshank and Wall-E. But to try and do our boy a little more justice. And not that this really helps a whole lot. I really liked, I tried to find some stuff that's different because I listened to Shawshank and like Road to Perdition and I was like, wow, these are awesome. But then I saw that he did Jarhead and I thought, that's a different movie. I gotta check that out. Mm-hmm. And I really liked it.
Nice.
I really liked what he did. You know, like whatever. But like... The soundtrack was really cool because I feel like he got to be really creative with it. Mm. I also liked Spectre.
Yeah.
I wanted to also listen to something where he had like a history and like a heritage that he had to honor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he did a fantastic job with that. You know, it's a James Bond film. So there's like just such a rich tradition that he has to pull from there.
Yeah.
And... You know, I will say Road to Perdition. I really liked that soundtrack.
That's one I was torn on. I almost went with that one, but that's a great one.
Yeah, very, very good. There's so much that he's done. I mean, like, if you just look at the films he's done, it's wild. I mean, films that have made me very emotional. Like, have been Thomas Newman films.
Yeah.
And I was not cognizant of that at the time, but I have no doubt that it played a non-trivial role in that.
Well, I'm not even going to try. We're not even going to try and list some of the other movies to go. Like, seriously, just pull up his filmography. It's just kind of stupid. You'll just see movie after movie where it's just like, oh, 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 oh. You know, it's just, that's he's one of those guys. So we're huge, huge fans of Thomas Newman. Whether you are cognizant of it or not, you are in some indirect or direct way also a fan of Thomas Newman. Be aware of the film composers. Keep an eye out for them. And with that, we want to give our boy Tom some love. So here is our defense of Thomas Newman. Show business and all of its arms is full of successful family dynasties. I'm sure a film scoring student at USC would give their left foot to be a fly on the wall at the Newman family reunion. Thomas admits his lineage, but he still managed to carve his own path. He often refers to one of his great mentors, Stephen Sondheim, for many of his underpinnings as a composer more than family members. And yet, there's no shame in his countenance when mentioning his familiar relationships and the opportunities that have consequently been afforded him. With or without his upbringing, I would contend that Thomas's success is not a mere byproduct of who his father was, but purely a result of an artist who honed his craft meticulously and practices it masterfully.
Film scores can really make or break a movie. At worst, you would hope that your music isn't distracting from the movie. At best, the soundtrack significantly enhances the experience. Thomas is an enhancer, but not in an overt or brash way. Rather than drowning in a palaver, he relies largely on repetition and stasis. Using a more subtle philosophy allows themes and emotive forces to propel the movie forward without distracting from the plot or over-dramatizing a scene. Sample creation, sound manipulation, and rhythmic forces tend to support these motives, creating a strong, palpable atmosphere. But true to what film composers ought to do, he stays within the bounds of the project. Sometimes that means leaving the more modern devices for more familiar symphonic arrangements, but maintaining the Newmanisms nevertheless.
Crucially, Newman's recognition that his work is serving the director's vision yields the best outcome. He is a creative force in his own right, but his creativity is serving a collaborative purpose. Films are attempting to convey some sort of narrative through various artistic mediums, and if any of them are done poorly, it will be noticed. Since the audio output of the film demands so much attention on the part of a viewer, Directors need to be sure that they hire someone talented, knowledgeable, humble, flexible, and efficient. Thomas has set the bar high and has inspired generations of film composers that are trying to meet those standards. Some are doing it, but many aren't. So what is a big budget director going to do when they need someone to exceed expectations? Call Thomas Newman, of course.
So thanks for listening. As is absolutely apparent in every way, we are huge fans of Thomas Newman. This was... We enjoy preparing for all of these episodes, but man, this was a treat. This was a lot of fun. And we really hope that you get something out of it and there's something that you can take to your film viewing experience. There's so much that goes into creating a great score, and Thomas Newman is truly a master at it. So we hope you check out something you've already seen, something you haven't seen yet, and really, really allow it to guide you through the story. But don't forget, we want to hear from you. Also, don't forget, you can see us on our website. We have a website.
Hey.
It's tmmpod.com. There you can listen to episodes, read the defense of the artist, and even check out a recommended listening from each episode. So we hope that you'll engage there. Check it out. There's a link in the description. So go there. But also slide into our DMs at tmmpod on Instagram, the Musician's Musician Podcast, also at tmmpod on Facebook. You can send us an email at themusiciansmusicianpodcast@gmail.com. All of these are good ways for you to get to us, and we hope that you do so. So give us your opinions. We'll give you ours. And until next time, thanks.